Hi, my name is Bob Marzano. I'm CEO of Marzano Research Laboratory in Denver, Colorado. And this segment of a set of videotapes is one in, as I said, a set of seven videotapes that discuss and describe the results of the What Works in Oklahoma School study that was conducted over the 2009 and 2010 academic year and the 2010-2011 academic year. This is the introductory tape, which is going to give a broad overview, and then there'll be six more of these that get into more specifics relative to the recommendations that came out of that study. First of all, it was a unique study in my experience, in the sense that the Oklahoma State Department of Education asked the question, gee, the elements that we consider to be important to effective schooling, do those elements really differentiate schools that are, you know, having maybe a little bit of trouble versus schools that, you know, aren't having trouble? Or stated differently, do those nine essential elements that we recommend all schools attend to, do they help provide guidance for schools in terms of, you know, what, if they want to get a little bit better, what they might focus on? And that's different from most state frameworks that I've worked with over the last 30 years, in that virtually every state has, you know, a set of elements that they say schools should consider, but those elements are drawn from the research across many you know, different situations and many different states, but it's taking past research and trying to apply it to your current situation, just assuming that because an element was found in the research, that it automatically applies to a school in a given state. What the Oklahoma State Department of Education decided to do is actually test that empirically and say, are our nine elements good discriminators in terms of schools within different status within the state? And it was, to some extent, a validity study on those nine essential elements. More importantly, though, the purpose of the study was to help identify recommendations that came out of the research that schools who want to improve, or schools who are, you know, in a certain status and want to get out of that status, you know, might focus on. Just some of the statistics here. As I mentioned, it covered two academic school years. It involved schools that were in the needs improvement status category, and match schools that weren't in the needs improvement status category. As you probably already know, that to be in this improvement category, in other words, if a school was classified as needing improvement, that typically meant that they did not meet AYP for two, you know, consecutive years. So what we found is we found 31 schools that were in the needs improvement category, and we matched those as closely as possible with 27 other schools that were not in the needs improvement category. The study in its entirety involved over 1,100 teachers, over 13,000 students, over 500 parents, and some 50 administrators. So it was a pretty robust study in terms of its representativeness, I would assert, as to what's going on in the state. It was conducted in two phases, so let me just summarize those phases. Phase one was basically the survey phase, and that's when we surveyed students, we surveyed building administrators, we surveyed teachers, and we surveyed parents, basically focusing in on the nine essential elements that the Department of Education has identified as critical variables in terms of things schools can do to enhance student achievement. Just to remind you of those, now there's a report on each of the phases, and that's available on the Department of Education website. To remind you of those, they are, they're called technically the essential elements in the Oklahoma framework. Curriculum, classroom evaluation and assessment, instruction, school culture, student, family, and community support, professional growth and development and evaluation, school leadership, the organizational structure of the school, and comprehensive and effective planning. Now, those are pretty familiar to most people have been in education for, you know, a couple decades or more. This really dates back to the early 80s and what were called the school correlates. And what's happened, states have taken those and adapted them, enhanced them over time. So it started off as a very, very good list. So one of the primary questions, at least in kind of a validity level, is do those really discriminate between, or stated differently, are the schools who are in the needs improvement category and this versus the schools and the schools that are not in the needs improvement category, are they the same relative to teacher perceptions and administrator perceptions and student perceptions on those nine categories? And actually, the findings were very, very clean. Both the administrators and the teachers, when we put those surveys together, what we found is that the schools who were in the needs improvement status typically had lower average scores than the typically, actually across the board, than the schools that were not in the needs improvement status. And what that means is that the administrators and the teachers in the schools, you know, who are in the needs improvement status, thought they were doing a poorer job in those areas, if you will, than the schools, than the teachers or administrators in the match schools that were not on the needs improvement status. Now, that doesn't mean they were doing a poor job in general. It just means they didn't have as high a score as they were. The responses weren't as positive as the those from the teachers and administrators in the schools that did not need categorized as not needing improvement. So that was a pretty big finding in terms of if I were a State Department person, I'd feel very good about that, because it says our framework is a good predictor between those two categories of schools. Another big finding from the phase one part, which is basically a survey phase, was that teachers and administrators in the schools, in the category of schools where they were categorized as needing improvement, tended to not agree as much in terms of what was happening in the schools as the administrators and teachers in the schools where they were not in the needs improvement status. Now, to state it differently, in the schools that were not classified as needing improvement, the teachers and administrators said, hey, they saw it the same way, the school strengths and school weaknesses. In the schools, you know, that were in the needs improvement category, the administrators might, you know, see the school as having a strength, where the teacher saw that very same variable as a weakness, or vice versa. The teachers might, you know, see something as a strength, and the administrators would see it as a weakness. So the level of agreement seemed to be a real good discriminating factor too. And then the student surveys got a little bit at the nine essential elements, but we tried to delve more into students' perceptions of the school in general, but also, you know, what was happening in the classroom. And I can actually read these to you because I think they were very, very telling. We had K-12 schools represented, but for students, we did not survey the first and second grade students, just because it's very hard to get survey data from them. But we did have a survey for grades 3 through 5 as a group, grades 6 through 8, and grades 9 through 12. And here's what we found. This is for grades 3 through 5. Some students' perceptions distinguish between non-improvement and improvement schools. These differences might disclose some possible improvement areas on which to focus. Specifically, in grades 3 through 5, the areas to note include students' respect for each other, the teachers making learning interesting, the teacher treating all students fairly, students' feeling of safety in the classroom, and the teacher regularly letting students know how they were doing in class. And again, the students from schools who were not on an improvement status, you know, had tended to record higher scores, higher perceptions than the students in schools that were on the needs improvement status. And what this implies, taken at face value, is that hey, if you're a school on improvement status, you might look at one of these areas here. That students feel that the school is run in such a way that students are, respect each other, that teachers make learning interesting, all students are treated fairly and the same. The safety of the school, you know, that you might want to make sure, look at, and our students perceive the school as being safe. And then the teacher regularly letting students know how well they're doing relative to specific learning goals and objectives. That was grades 3 through 5. In grades 6 through 8, I'll read again. An area to note is behavioral issues, especially the school's tolerance of inappropriate behavior, the school clearly communicating rules and procedures for students, and students feeling safe in class. Again, those are all behavioral issues, but if you take these findings at face value, what that implies is that if you're in improvement status in grade 6 through 8, and your teachers and grades and administrators in grade 6 through 8, you might look at, well, man, how are we doing on this? Do students feel, relative to these behavioral issues, that we're doing a good job? And if not, you know, what are we going to do about it? Another area to focus on in grade 6 through 8 may be teacher fairness in general and grading practices more specifically. Now remember, this is across quite a few students. That's grades 9 through 12. Behavioral issues were again a concern, specifically the school's ability to clearly communicate rules and expectations for students, having discipline procedures that are fair and consistent, and intolerance around inappropriate behavior in the school stood out as an important difference in student perceptions in non-improvement versus improvement schools. So those are pretty strong messages when they come from so many students, and the pattern seems to be the same. Doesn't mean it applies to your particular school, but it sure points to areas that a school might look to see how well are we doing on these areas. That was phase one. It was all survey data. Very robust. Now, I'm just giving you the highlights here. I'm not going over the parent survey data and how teachers compared with administrators and specific items. That's all in the reports. We recommend that you look at those. Phase two, that was in years 2001 and academic year 2010-2011. During that phase, we actually went out to the schools, and we had teams of people from our research lab, our associates, all experienced teachers, administrators who've been in many, many classrooms, and they went in and interview with an administrator or administrators in a building, and then visited teachers' classrooms and talked to teachers, but primarily visited teachers' classrooms to look at what was going on in the classroom. So phase two focused very much on what's happening in the classroom. So there were on-site visits. In each school, a certain number of teachers were randomly selected and videotaped, so we could analyze those videotapes in some depth. Now, to analyze the videotapes, we used a particular model of instruction called the Art and Science of Teaching, which includes 41 different elements that cover routines, setting clear goals, use of formative assessments, different instructional strategies, management strategies, pretty much covers the whole range of what I would assert research tells us are areas to examine if you're trying to identify things to work on in the classroom. Here's the basic finding, that those categories of instruction make a difference, that the schools where teachers were observed either in person or on videotape as doing, using more strategies and using those strategies effectively, in those schools the achievement in math and language arts was higher. And so no surprise finding there. Basically it says a good instruction matters. So if you're a school on the needs improvement in the needs improvement category, even a school that's not, you're doing fine. You say, where can we work to get better? Instruction's a no-brainer. You can't go wrong by saying, let's help every teacher get better in instruction here. An aspect of the second phase that we didn't plan for but kind of showed up was stemmed from the fact that nine of the schools, over the course of the study, nine of the schools that were in the needs improvement category got out of that category, within a single year. So we really focused on them and said, what can we see here? Are there any patterns that might indicate what they did to have that, you know, quick jump in terms of status. And we did identify, you know, one or one and a half, depending on how you want to count. Those schools tended to work more as a team, you know, that the administration and the faculty operated more as a team. In general, they used a PLC, professional learning community process, to help get together, identify a focus area or two, and then collectively work together on that focus area. And that's actually not very surprising either. If you know, you know, my work at all, I've looked at the research for years, and what's coming out in the literature now, you know, more and more prominently, is the collective efficacy of a school. I believe that's Roger Goddard's term, collective efficacy of a school, is a significant predictor of achievement within the school. The extent to which the administrators and teachers believe together we can make an impact here on students. So that's kind of a nice surprise finding. Now, this was the first video segment of a series of seven. The next six will get in more depth about specific recommendations that come out of these findings. But we recommend highly that you take a look at the reports. There are three reports: phase one, phase two, and phase three. There are also individual school reports that cover the same material, but just for individual schools in the study. The final comment here in this particular segment is that I want to thank the teachers, the administrators, the students, and the parents, who graciously agreed to, be part of these studies. We took time from their day. We really realized that. They were all very candid in their responses about what they thought they were doing well and what they thought they could improve on. And the members of our team that went out and visited schools would come back, continually throughout the process and just, talk about really some wonderful people they met and some wonderful things they saw, and just always enthusiastic and inspired by the educators they had met. So I want to thank those people. As a state, I think you should collectively thank those people. So if you happen to be one of those schools that were in the study, give yourself a pat on the back and, thanks from us and the rest of the state. If you're not one of those schools, but know one, you might say thanks a lot for what you've done, because they provide very, very useful information about steps a school can make. And the next six video segments will address those specific recommendations.